Kia ora, everybody. This is Monday number seminar 29. We're talking with Charlie Finch, the both famous and infamous art critic from New York City. I've posted up his background on the blog, so you should be able to follow in and tune in. Interesting guy. Okay, so it's October 24, 2011. We've got 7 o'clock in New York City, and we're here with Bob Dobbs and Charlie Finch.
Welcome. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, man. I'm thrilled. I'm really excited to have you here. This is going to be great. Bob, are you still there?
Yep, just getting the recording back up going. So this is Charles Finch, F-I-N-C-H. Now, Charlie, I found about you from our mutual, your good friend, my acquaintance, Carol Lopresto, who's been a great contribution to this McLuhan and Maui series. And I was amazed. You did this review of Zappa's Freakout and made the outrageous claim that there was no art in the whole art world over the last 45 years to equal the musical masterpiece, Freakout. Now, that's a pretty controversial statement, considering that you're in the art world and you're dissing him, but it really brings up an issue about what is effective communication for the masses or for elites. And so you could say revolutionary art happened in the revolution in communication expression was visual art in the 20s. Revolutionary communication in the 60s was music. And then where are we today? And we'll get to that. But I think you're right to sort of bring Frank into the question about what was worth, what's staying powerful over the last 40 years. Can you elaborate a bit more about what you mean by the challenge of Freakout to the art world?
When I bought Freakout in 1966, it was a revolutionary experience. It was an album covered with wild, crazy people, colorful images. It was a double fold-out two-disc album, which was very rare back then. The music itself speaks to all the concerns that we have in America right now, such as you have in Occupy Wall Street. Who are the brain police? You're probably wondering why I'm here. Minnesota. Basically, a kind of satirical look at the nihilistic situation in America 45 years ago. Nothing has changed. And I was trying to convey to people who've never heard of it, like my younger readers, the impact that buying this record and putting it on the turntable had on a 13-year-old boy, myself. One of the problems we have in culture is that media gets hotter and hotter, the devices get hotter and hotter. There are no such thing as cool media anymore, and this tends to obliterate the past. And many of my readers, I have a lot of younger readers, probably have never heard of Freakout. They've heard of Zappa, but I wanted to convey what that moment was like for me.
Okay, that's something I hadn't thought of. I should look at this. You are having to talk to 20-year-olds. I mean, that's the reason why you do this. Even younger. So let's say someone your generation, did anybody on that age who would know of Zappa but never thought it was significant, did they comment on it to you, your article?
I got a lot of response from people like me who were 58 and older who had a very similar experience from Freakout. I must have gotten 75 to 100 emails after the piece came out, and they very much appreciated that I brought up the specific experience of buying Freakout in 1966, and they too felt that it was a lost masterpiece.
Very good. Are you of the school that the 60s mothers were better than the 80s mothers, or did you enjoy Frank as he evolved?
Well, my favorite Zappa performance of all on YouTube has to be Stairway to Heaven in Cleveland, which I'm guessing is 87 or 88.
That's the 88 tour. That's the last year.
I mean, that's unbelievable if you've never seen that.
Yeah.
So I stuck through them all the way. Of course, I love the Tipper. I shudder to think how long Frank has been dead. But I go all the way back to the Steve Allen show. Remember?
Did you see that?
Yeah, remember when he makes the takes
the bicycle
parts and Steve box him and he hangs in there. I didn't see it when it happened, but I've seen it since it happened.
Yeah.
And I saw the mothers at the Fillmore East. The only time I ever saw them live was in the summer of '69 at the Fillmore East, when I wrote about and in another article, and that was a tremendously transformative experience.
Right, and you were only 13.
16 at the time, yes. I saw the Who's very first concert in America at RKO 58th Street when I was 14.
Okay. Now,
Cream was on the bill too. How about that?
Wow. So I saw five concerts in the 88 tour. So I saw Stairway to Heaven five times.
Wow.
And at one of the concerts, my friend Ian Arlett came. And halfway through it, he's just agog at what he's hearing. He goes, "My God, Roger Plant would fucking drop dead if he heard this."
The dogs barking and everything.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Amazing. And the great horns. Is it Roger Plant? Who am I thinking of? What are the...
Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah, Robert Plant. So the... So you saw what Zappa did. I mean, he's obviously Duke Ellington, the Beethoven Mozart of music in modern culture. Would you go that far? To me, it's obvious.
Yes. It's funny. My good friend Carolee Schneemann, who's in her 70s now, of course, worked as Varese's secretary. And
I know. I know Carolee. And
she doesn't quite hear me.
Right now.
Right now, yeah. She's about half an hour away from where I'm speaking to you.
Right. She, back in the late 90s, we did a few conferences together out in Banff, and she told me, like, in the late 50s, she was an assistant to Edgar Varese down in the village.
Absolutely. She was his archivist and secretary.
Yeah, that explains a lot where she got her jump on everybody.
I recommend, we're very close friends, I recommend her new book of letters, which I reviewed for ArtNet, which came out about 8 months ago, which is a roadmap to all of avant-garde American culture since the 50s.
Yeah.
Her personal letters back and forth, just unbelievable book.
Okay, I think I saw that review a couple weeks ago. I looked at it. Okay, so you've got Zappa performing the traditional, almost 19th century role of the artist, providing an anti-environment to the scene, to the media, virtual reality. And then you have McLuhan talking about it on another level. Now, Jerry Fiaca, he was an employee of Zappa. And, of course, he was very impressed with Zappa, thought he was a genius. But when he read Mechanical Bride in the early 90s, I turned him on to McLuhan. He said, "What do you think?" He said, "Well, that's on a whole different level from Zappa. I'm like, this is incredible." And he's now become a real devotee of Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan and James Joyce, and has a reading club in L.A. But we're always discussing the thing about Zappa, McLuhan, and other things. Now, are you aware of Ben Watson, who did the book Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play?
No.
Okay, he's a pretty smart British critic, and he approaches Zappa through Finnegan's Wake and Joyce and Wyndham Lewis and R&B and Johnny Otis and all that stuff. So we have an interesting dialogue, but I get a feeling that you can bring in a lot of these other people, like Carolee, who I am aware of and been involved with a lot through the years, because I've been in New York many times for the last 50 years. So what I find interesting is a person named Arthur Croker. Have you ever heard of Arthur Croker?
No.
Okay, so he's a professor presently in Victoria, British Columbia. And he did a book in 1984 called Innes McLuhan Grant. That refers to Harold Innes, Marsh McLuhan, and George Grant. And the title is, what is it, Technology in the Canadian Mind, Andrew?
Yeah,
Technology in the Canadian Mind. So he's trying to establish, revive McLuhan in the mid-80s when nobody even in communications departments were allowed to bring up McLuhan. He does a really good book, and then he goes on and develops a theory of the virtual the theory of the virtual clash, because he's a Marxist, a leftist, or a Nietzschean, a Heideggerian, and an expert on all the Pomo thinkers, a good friend of Baudrillard. And I think he produced a really important book in 1993 and 94 called The Data Trash. And parallel to it was a book called Spasm, So, with what you do in Coagula in mind, let's look at Croker's definition of art, how he approaches art as the institution of art, painting, sculpture, maybe not so much music, but maybe. He says, he's coined the term crash art. And he says on page 33 of the book Spasm, which came out in about 93, what is art? Now, this is before the internet has really taken off, all right? This is what's interesting. What is art in the age of high energy physics? No longer can art be situated within reflection theory, nor can art function as a critic. Art is now a quantum fluctuation, a phase shift where all the old classical certainties dissolve and where everything can finally be uncertain, probabilistic, and indeterminate. Outside time and running across multiple spaces, art can finally become a violent edge, a space for the cancellation of all the big signs of modernity and for their immediate reversal into their opposite sign forms. Quantum art, therefore, is that point where the artistic imagination actually becomes the uncertain universe of which particle physics could only dream. Art, then, as a quantum singularity in which all the energies of the black hole of America fall back upon themselves, concentrating with their energy until it pulses and implodes. Here, art is a culture lab for working out the inner laws of physics, technology, and power. Next paragraph. Art becomes interesting only when it does not exist except as a sign of its own liquidation, a manic art of dispersion and retrieval that marks the dissolution and cancellation of the social field, a quantum art that moves into sonic overdrive, actually dissolving into a detritus of acceleration and infinite speed. Now, when I read that, I think of your friend Walter Robinson's Gallery Beat TV show on Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
I cite a lot of examples of contemporary artists whose work is totally akin to this kind of philosophical approach. An artist like Thomas Hirshhorn, for example, who makes huge assemblages of all sorts of different objects. For example, one of his most recent installations was about suicide bombers and was made up entirely of thousands and thousands of objects, from prayer cards to newspaper clippings to actual parts of bombs, etc., assembled in a massive 10,000 square feet gallery space. And Hirshhorn, of course, has been in the Venice Biennale. He's represented by Barbara Gladstone, a major gallery in New York. He has a kind of market and hundreds of thousands of dollars for his installations, and his politics are very radical. Now, here you have a radical installation artist who is dovetailing with really the most conservative elements in society, i.e. the wealthy. And this is the fundamental contradiction we have in art today, in that we have artists dealing with media, every kind of technological means possible. They have a lot of money, at least the stars do, to make whatever they want, and they're always trying to make, in the Baudrillardian term, a simulacrum of the world in their art. It's like Borges's old idea of the map, where if you draw a map of the world that simulates the world itself, the map becomes the world, becomes the size of the world. That's what artists are trying to do. They're trying to make bigger, larger, more encompassing works that deal with every kind of political and cultural issue out there. This is as far away from something like vorticism or futurism or cubist painting, all things that, because their media were restricted at the time in terms of what they could use, nevertheless anticipate this kind of art. Another artist is Jason Rose, who died a couple of years ago, who built a huge installation based on a combination of Mecca and what Mecca looks like out of branded commercial objects from Western life. The basic problem, though, in terms of the business of art, is that it's marketed for a tiny, tiny minority, rich people. And because rich people have a tremendous amount of surplus capital to spend, and they can only buy so many cars or houses or boats, they ultimately end up spending their surplus capital on art. And that contradiction has got to break down. Always does in life. So Coker anticipates basically what the fundamental state of the art universe is now, as I see it.
So you don't find it over jargonistic, implausible, what he's saying?
I can live with a lot of jargon. I mean, I'm a very concise writer myself, a very different kind of writer. McLuhan, if you read him, you know, he uses little pericopes, descriptions. His mind basically goes over an entire landscape of what he's talking about. So it's just a different kind of writing. Like Gertrude Stein is a very different kind of writing from Ernest Hemingway. You know, there are many different ways to write. But his fundamental point, I think, anticipates what's going on in the art world now. And, of course, since this is the world that I'm in, I'm going to make references to a lot of artists that you guys have probably never heard of, which I hope you don't mind.
No, it's good.
But I need to be grounded in the specificity of certain kinds of art to talk about.
Okay, so McLuhan wrote in 1960 a document that was a Understanding Media before Understanding Media came out in 64. He built on it with Understanding Media. It's called Project 69. And he talks about...
3 years after it came out.
Beg your pardon?
I read it 3 years after it came out in high school.
Okay, good. In Project 69, he has a good section on the art world, and he says that the artist always is tuned into what's happening, and it's largely invisible pressures and tensions that the artist picks up on and perceptual challenges. And he said art in the first half of the 20th century was revolutionary because it was a revolutionary time of new technologies coming in. But he said by World War II, the role of art to provide and anticipate new means of perception, what he called an anti-environment, could art itself, sculpture, painting, music, could not be anti-environmental once you get into the 50s. So he said...
This argument.
Beg your pardon?
I am familiar with this argument.
Okay, good. So he says the media environments, the television form, then computers, these media environments offer anti-environments. And he comes up with this definition in the late 60s. Only a rapid series of innovations can serve as an ersatz anti-environment. In other words, you can't make an anti-environment by the time you get into the global theater of the 60s, the mixed corporate media... a celebration of all kinds of expression and all levels. You can only be an anti-environment if you present a series of innovations, either you individually or a corporation, like maybe Microsoft, all the different windows they offer. That's a series of innovations that sparks people, makes them feel they're getting a new level of perception. But McLuhan realistically sees that is not serving the role of art as an anti-environment. So he takes the question, what can be an anti-environment in the global theater? And so when I read what you guys do in Coagula, you're totally pointing out what you've just said, the contradictions of the wealthy and the use of art for an old 19th century thing of propping up money itself as a currency, making it some kind of value standard. It's like the new gold standard. While all this other stuff is going on in the popular expression of technologies, beginning with the counterculture and rock music, you could say in the 60s, which Zappa was the king of. When you go around to the art galleries, are you going around as a someone who's preserving some values, maybe even anti-environmental values, or are you don't think it's even relevant what goes on? You're just spying on what the wealthy are doing.
Yeah, can I just add another layer on top of that? Charlie, I was interested. I'm just reading this Cultural Shocker, this article by Daniel Pinchback
from The Voice in 98.
Yeah, and you make a really interesting claim in this one, which is about most art sucks. I was wondering, are you actually an artist, like as opposed to, do you understand what you do as the work of an artist or a critic, or is
well,
this boundary broken down?
I've been called a conceptual artist in terms of, I can answer that question with an anecdote. I spent 25 years in Democratic Party politics, working for a lot of politicians. I was Gary Hart's traveling aide in the 1984 campaign, and I had always worked in art as well, curating shows and doing a lot of other things. And I can remember running into Jean-Michel Basquiat in 1987 at a party, and I said, you know, I'm thinking of going into the art world full-time. I've been a political activist for a long time. And he says, what you need to do is sell yourself the way you used to sell politicians. And he was absolutely right. So I set out creating a persona for myself. First, it was a duality with this female character, Janet Preston, and basically imposed myself on the art world. And, you know, I had a lot of fans and a lot more enemies. And even though I'm now sort of an aging critic and have been in a very establishment company for a long time, I still am really hated and reviled for what I do, because I'm basically, for me, it's about the writing and my audience. You know, you're not a writer unless you have an audience, and I have a pretty faithful audience. And I just try to call it as I see it, which in the art world, unlike, say, the theater world or even the music world, where there's also a lot of conflict, gets people's backs up. Why? Because the fundamental art audience and market for art is only wealthy people.
It's the old world.
Yeah,
it's the old.
Absolutely.
It's an image of an established. It creates an. McLuhan's society becomes an art form. A genetically engineered situation. That's what art serves.
No.
It's to create a sense that there's a hierarchy.
It's been like that in the history of Western art and Eastern art for a long, long time. I mean, I think if you look at any civilization, you can't object. I mean, you can't deny the fact that art is always the servant of the wealthy. Now, can you guys keep talking? Because I just have to run to the bathroom. It'll take 5 seconds.
Yeah, no, no problem.
Don't mind. Let's put the
So, Andrew, what is the theme that I don't think you got your question? Where would you go with what with his answer?
Yeah, no, it's just I got a sense that you were categorizing him or putting Charlie in this this critic, you know, like the spy critic commentator type situation. And as I've read through all these pieces, I think one of the defining things that, at least as I understand it, is Charlie appears to be breaking all these boundaries and stuff like that. So he's part artist, but then he's also presents the critic as an activist. Also, the critic is consumer. There's all these these barriers and boundaries.
Right. You see him as definitely a performance artist. Put him in that category too.
Yeah, and politician. He's a new wave politician in a sense.
New wave? Did you say?
Yeah, yeah. In the sense, like that, this approach to genius that I've got in these other ones. You're
I'm
looking
back.
At like the.
Oh wait, he's back. He's back, Andrew. What were we going to say? Charlie, you're back. You were going to say something.
I don't want to interrupt Andrew though.
Okay.
No, please don't be polite. It's I was just pushing Bob on your category and boundary slippage in this. You've kind of got this artist as unacknowledged legislator of the world, and in stepping out of politics yourself into this art critic's performance piece, that seems to be it's almost like you're writing about yourself the whole time, Charlie. It's fascinating.
Well, if you go into my ArtNet columns, there is, you know, Rauschenberg always said that you have to get between the space between art and life. Mencken said that criticism is the highest form of writing because basically you're using what you criticize as an extension to talk about yourself, which I firmly believe in it. And the reason I'm a different kind of critic in our little world, the art world, is because everything I write comes out of my experience and my experience only, rather than describing what's there or this or that. And it's very personalized, you know, my style of writing. What can I say? It's what I do. And I'm not going to change it at 58. I mean, it's a very different kind of writing than, say, McLuhan's kind of writing or Joyce, or not to compare myself to them, which I'm not, but it's just, it's personal, it's critical, but I like to think that it encompasses everything about the art world and beyond. Let me make a point about someone like Bowie, or Duchamp, or Carolee Schneemann. The greatest artists are those who deal with everything around them, every kind of medium, every kind of experience. Bowie started out as a visual artist, and then he became a mime. His first acts on British TV were as a mime, and he was always grounded in every kind of experience and trying to push the boundaries of the ways he created as well as his material. This has a shamanistic quality, of course, and that is the one thing that can elevate or redeem art practice away from the prison of wealth. If you push, like Zappa, against the boundaries where you're always going to say, I don't care if I'm popular, I don't care if you buy my records, push, 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 push. Look at Lou Reed, who I had dinner with last week, to drop a name, when he came out with Bethel Machine Music, right? In the mid-60s, Lester Bangs was the only critic to praise it. It was basically two discs of insane ambient noise.
That's mid-70s, not 60s, mid-70s.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Look at Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist who just spent a few months in prison in a room the size of a closet with a light shown in his face for 24 hours by rotating groups of guards. Another artist that answers the bell in terms of universality. That is what an artist should be, any kind of an artist. There's the shamanistic quality, the interactive quality, the reaching out to an audience, and then the constant making everyone around you, even your closest supporters, uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So the other question I was going to have you on, if you could talk to, please, is the boundary in the 21st century or in or late 20th century between art and religion. Because as soon as you start pointing to this shamanistic quality, aren't you you're kind of saying, well, that's gone.
Art replaced religion, at least in terms of the high advanced precincts of civilization. One of the big examples of it is in communist China right now, and I'm very anti-Chinese communist and anti the regime there, which doesn't mean I don't have problems with America either. I certainly do. But China has set out to basically give a lot of their artists who cooperate, their contemporary artists, a ton of money as a way to project the Chinese image into the world as a substitute for religion. Ai Weiwei is someone who resisted that and got imprisoned for his troubles. Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Prize winner, Peace Prize winner, is also in jail for writing the documents of Charter 8, the freedom documents within China. So, yes, I mean, one of the real reasons for the boom of art, both as a means of consumption, as a career that educated, well-off people pursue, and also as a kind of cat's paw for other kind of media, even though it's not as popular as Katy Perry or some television show, is precisely this religious function.
On that same thing, then, is there's a tension then between the shamanic and also the prophetic, you know, with the prophetic being sort of slightly anticipatory, and in terms of protest, there seems to be an odd tension there, because if I've understood, you've propped up and celebrate this like game-changing visions of art and executions of art that have a prophetic dimension as well.
The prophetic dimension, of course, within the art world is complicated by the whole idea of postmodernism, which argues that there's nothing new under the sun, and that everything's essentially recyclable in terms of advanced Western culture. But artists challenge that assumption all the time. There are basically four or five, at least, different paradigms of what the role of the artist is in society. Baudrillard, of course, with the whole idea of simulacra, that in the Borges model, that artists are essentially trying to reproduce the world in front of them to the point of absolute artificiality. And this is, by the way, where the iPad and the iPhone come in, and it is the fulfillment of so many of McLuhan's basic ideas and assumptions. Moving toward a universe, what Bob called in the McLuhan term an anti-environment, which is entirely artificial. Artificial in the sense that the brain can merge only with what is artificial, that nature has disappeared. There are a number of artists dealing with this issue in a big, big way. And in that sense, prophecy ceases to exist because there is no future. The past is obliterated because there's no real understanding of the past except as a postmodern function of creativity in the now. And the future essentially stops. The idea that there's any kind of progress, any kind of spiritual fulfillment, any kind of awakening also disappears. So the artist becomes a kind of materialistic shaman, constantly arranging and rearranging the materials of the world to make a new creative statement over and over again. You could argue that the greatest art object today, which is simultaneously a savior of humanity and a killer of evil and also a major force of evil in itself, are the drone airplanes that the United States uses to wipe out various terrorists and innocents and everyone else. The drone airplane would be is the ultimate art object of our culture, in my view. And there are many artists trying to build their own kinds of killer, aesthetically killing drone airplanes.
Yeah, that's a nice call. Just the last one, which is, I guess, a personal thing, and then I'm sure Bob can go anywhere, is in terms of your audience, and you've got this relationship with your audience, have you ever felt hamstrung in terms of expressing maybe the fuller and more complicated dimensions of your thought, insofar as you focused on this performance of moving around art spaces and then writing for the zine world, or is it has it been an appropriate mode of expression for you?
I mean, I live for my audience. I work for my audience. My audience, positive or negative, is always responsive. The worst thing is to have no audience, because then you can't create.
Yeah.
And the audience, the internet, of course, is the greatest gift that a writer could ever have, because it preserves your archives, it makes all your writing instantly accessible all over the world, and it means the response also comes from a lot of out-of-the-way places. I don't think I'm blessed, frankly, that everything I write, like just talking to you guys now, gets a response totally unanticipated. It's really what keeps me going, and I'm an old sick man. I mean, it's fantastic. And I'm also technologically, like, I don't have an iPad, I don't have an iPhone, I have an old Apple that I can barely use or know how to use. But the audience is there. God bless them. You know, they keep me going. That's the one part of my life that's never been a problem.
Bob, are you right? You're still listening away?
Yeah. No, I've got questions piling up, statements. So you're finished for the moment?
Yeah. I was just.
No, that's good. Good stuff. Nice. Now, what comes to mind is McLuhan's three Copernican revolutions. He said that Copernicus, the first guy in history, was the first Copernican revolution, where the image of man was thrown to the edge of the universe rather than being at the center of the situation. Then the second Copernican revolution, he said, was Kant, who moved people into an inner space. And he said the third, and this is the interesting part, the third Copernican revolution, and I think this would begin with the time of the vortices and Joyce Pound and those guys, was the Copernican revolution of pattern recognition, because information was taking over as the ground of society. And by the 70s, the categories of being an artist or a scientist, a politician, a worker, whatever, they were all subsumed by the fact that the word made the market. And the word was what the White House said or what Walter Cronkite said. That was the information pattern of the day that established the society, the establishment, the what is, the reality. So that McLuhan saw that anybody can be a pattern recognizer and create information that can be useful for who knows who. So art, as a traditional visual form of pattern recognition, and music as an acoustic, had to deal with the fact that the media, which is really the global theater of the New York Times feeding off of the television news people feeding off the New York Times, and every other activity that the magazines and Time and Newsweek covered, that seamless web of information was what commentary was up against. And so that's why you see conceptual art and then performance art, all kinds of expression called the art world, was just people trying to create pattern recognition for a while. They didn't think that the pattern they created that offered some poise or perspective or celebration or stimulus or pissed-offness that it would last for a long time. So in that quote by Croker, where he's talking about art canceling, if you understand it's an information society and that is the ground, then everything that Charlie just said can fit into that larger structure of pattern recognition. Now, what happens at the time of the Internet is everybody, especially Web 2.0, can make a pattern using Absolutely. Whatever resources.
Absolutely. Do you know how many artists walk around with iPhones? I mean, there was a recent study done at MIT which said that the iPhone is such a perfect interfacer with the brain and the emotions that people have an emotional relationship with their iPhone equivalent to a human relationship.
Yeah.
Because the iPhone, the elements of interactivity with it are so broad and so quick. And I have to go back to the bathroom again, so hold on 1 second. I just said
okay,
that.
Now that's good.
Stay right there, hold on.
Yeah. So, Andrew, the categories of art and religion and shamanism don't work. And so, but when we use words, we have to use categories from the English language or any language, which are referring to institutions and generally hardware situations. And art is like the software pattern recognizer. You and I know that that is not the categories we live in when everybody has an iPhone or a chip body.
Yeah, yeah. So, and speaking of categories, Bob, I was wondering whether you'd just offered a your equivalent of the stealth drone.
Oh yeah, thanks for reminding me of that. Like, they're looking at a hardware weapon as an art form. They're missing the information pattern bomb. Like, TV is way more dangerous, McLuhan said in the 50s, than the atomic bomb. I deal with the software patterns of the Android meme as the real bomb. I don't specialize in hardware fetish.
Now, I'd like to bring up two names to kind of move this conversation to a separate plane, because they come from opposite poles in terms of this idea of pattern recognition. One is Gurdjieff and the other is Krishnamurti.
Very good. You're right. You walked into Dobstown there, Charlie. So go ahead.
I'll start with Gurdjieff. My uncle Roy Finch, who was a Wittgenstein scholar, was an apostle of Gurdjieff's when Gurdjieff lived in New York in the 30s. And Gurdjieff would meet with these apostles over on 6th Avenue in a restaurant, a delicatessen, and with his dog. He had a big sheepdog, and he would say, I want all of you, my dog wants a cabbage, and I'm giving you each a brown paper bag, and I want you all to go out and find the most succulent, beautiful cabbage you can find and be back here in half an hour. There'd be about a dozen of them. This is around 1932, and they'd all run out, and they each come back with a cabbage in a brown paper bag, and Gurdjieff would look at them and say, my dog doesn't like cabbages.
Good point.
Gurdjieff, of course, was a master of dealing in terms of pattern recognition with the idea of deception and false information. He argued in his writings that deception and false information are, in a way, a path to enlightenment because there's no such thing as true information. Krishnamurti, in my view, comes from an opposite direction. If you read a book like Think on These Things, which is a series of Krishnamurti's late lectures, he was deeply, deeply offended by the confusion of modernity and materialistic needs. And, of course, he always, since he had been reified as a messiah and rejected it as a youth by rich people, he said stripping away in order to achieve clarity of mind so that you really think is the basic mission of the individual in the modern world. What he would think of these tremendous social networking and technological advances, I could tell you what he would think. He would argue that Facebook and the concept of friending in Facebook is a Gurdjieffian piece of false information. That if you go on Facebook and you put up these images and have these interactions, even with people that you know, that what you are doing is essentially eliminating the idea of friendship in service to a technological demand from Facebook that you are so-called, quote, making friends, unquote. You follow me?
Yes.
So we have the pull of Gurdjieff, which is trying to transfer falsity into a different kind of truth, and Krishnamurti's idea of the stripping away. Two functions to preserve one's individuality in the world.
I think McLuhan would say Krishnamurti is Platonist and Gurdjieff is Aristotelian.
I think he would, yes. I want to take it back a step. Anyway, continue with that, Bob.
You want me to continue? Well, McLuhan quoted Coleridge back in the 50s, and this is back, 200 years ago in the middle of the Gutenberg galaxy, that there were two types of views. You were a Platonist or an Aristotelian. The Platonist, and then McLuhan wrote an essay in the early 50s on the Manichaean Gnosticism underlying Platonism and Aristotelianism. And Platonism was, this is a fallen world, Manichaean version of Platonism. This is a fallen world, I must get out of it through time and descend beyond time through will and morality and uprightness and discipline. The Aristotelian, then Gnostic branch of that, plunges into the world because it considers the world in the sense as a ricocheting bunch of mirror images, and that you annihilate yourself in the hoi polloi of experience. You don't try to transcend it. Now, McLuhan then said this Platonic Gnostic tendency became the dominant metaphor in art and culture and criticism in the Gutenberg galaxy because the book emphasize abstract detachment. But the electronic age flips us back into Gnostic Aristotelians, plunging into the simulacrum and annihilating ourselves or being cynically aware of that. And also,
because last night, if I may interrupt for one second,
go ahead.
I was listening to Jimi Hendrix's song, Room Full of Mirrors, because I was trying to anticipate some metaphors I might use in this colloquy here.
Yeah.
And I thought that the world we live in now, the iPad, iPhone world, is a room full of mirrors, but all the mirrors are facing outward away from you.
Yes, and that might be Web 2.0. Web 2.0 puts you in the position to modulate all those mirrors any way you want.
Right.
It changes it. And we did a really brilliant discussion last week on Web 3.0, which hopefully someday you'll get a chance to listen to, and then we'll talk about that. Because that deals with Occupy Wall Street and that phenomenon. But back to this Aristotelian. So McLuhan noticed that electric environments, beginning with radio, went around the Gutenberg dialectic between Plato and Aristotle and the Gnostic subtext. And he called that the tactile position in the interval. The gap was where the action is. And we actually all lived in the gap. And he said in the mid-60s that the average person is quite aware because there's so many media environments they're forced to interact with that they don't get embedded in any particular one like slower cultures did. So actually, he said, we were living at the highest decibels of consciousness in this global theater environment because just somnambulistically, people were forced to be detached because they had to deal with so many different modalities and biases in each media environment. That's a really important perception that the art world should wrestle with, or should have back then.
Well, I mean, the art world is, artists themselves are wrestling with all of these issues all the time. And I can cite many, many different artists that are dealing with these issues. For example, one artist you should look up on YouTube is Kiki Serror, K-I-K-I-S-E-R-O-R, who's based in San Francisco, used to be in New York. And she gets into these chat rooms, and she makes both art objects and videos out of a constant waking, I think it's called Chat Bunny or something that she's in now, where she gets stimulated by and stimulates in reverse as many different people as possible and then breaks it down into creations.
An instant pattern or artifact.
Yes, yes. And,
McLuhan defined camp art. He said people like camp art, this is in the 60s, because it gives an instant replay of their lives. She's giving an instant replay of the simulation.
Absolutely. That's what it is. And she distorts it a bit and everything, but she's so deep into it, and it happens so fast, and she turns out these creations. And she's exhibited all over the world. I mean, she had an exhibit at Freud's home in Vienna, for example, about 5 years ago, of this kind of art. One thing she deals with, though, is how this kind of world distorts personal feelings of pleasure, sexual and physical pleasure, and basically slices and dices the pleasure principle within individuality. So there are greater heights of ecstasy that are faster and faster, but also conversely feelings of depression and abandonment as well.
Right. You've probably heard me talk about that's the chemical body, and she's talking about the advantages of the chip body.
Yes. Yes. Continue with that, please.
Right. Now, I want to go back to lead into it. Gurdjieff, the way you talked about him, he was an artist of the mouth. He molded and played with people with language, through language, right?
Absolutely.
And exercises, kinetic exercises.
Absolutely.
So he was an artist of, here we are in the radio era, in the 2030s, and I've discussed Gurdjieff with Joyce and McLuhan through a medium. That was done years ago. And that's interesting. And Gurdjieff said that he was not in the public level of Joyce, and he needed to make money more scrappily. Whereas Joyce had an image and a function in the book world, so he had money coming in. So Gurdjieff is scrapping around like a new age circuit hustler.
Well,
but
it's a little bit of a distortion to portray Joyce as having a lot of money coming in.
No, he didn't have a lot, but he had republic resources. He didn't have to care about anybody to get paid. Gurdjieff had to fake personal involvement with a group of people.
True.
Right? Joyce is just writing stuff
true.
For Transition magazine. Go ahead.
Yeah,
he would write for Transition. Anyways, so here's Gurdjieff. When verbal language is obsolesced by the radio environment in communication, in McLuhan terms, and so he turns spoken language into an art form. And even muscular kinetic muscles, because the industrial age is an extension of the kinetic senses. So he's a combination of the visual and the kinetic around the chemical body in response to something that one person couldn't deal with, the radio environment. Because the radio environment is going to go on and have huge tribal effects and lead to the Depression and World War II. Now, Gurdjieff and Christian Murty couldn't do that. Now, I've written how McLuhan goes further than Christian Murty, and I've always thought of Gurdjieff in that. I like the distinction you make. And so you look at these Christian Murty, you didn't really finish. What is he valuing? What is Christian Murty valuing? The Gnostic quest?
No, I don't think Christian Murty ultimately is valuing the Gnostic quest. He values the preservation, the integrity of the individual.
And speech and silence. So he's taken the integrity of the chemical body and the astral body. And the astral body is all the literature that's written in religion and occult context as believing there's more than what our senses see. He represents something that's more, what I call the astral body genre of information, plus the chemical body as an anti-environment to the simulation. And in the long run, that's more Platonic, Gurdjieff is, he engages down the City Cafe right there on the street. He's Aristotelian. But both of them are obsolete, and that's the role of McLuhan, is to come in and deal with the mystical tradition, the integrity vision, anything, all those values, higher values, including the cliche as an archetypal experience. All that McLuhan saw that television was doing. He saw the beginning of the Android meme or the simulation was beginning to be Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti to the people. You get that?
Yes. Let's get back to Zap. First of all, is Andrew?
Now we're bringing Zappa. Very good.
I'm here.
Good, Andrew. Andrew, do you want to jump in here?
No, I'm good. This is we're at a good place now.
Let's bring in Zappa. Zappa in the 60s could be seen, if one was aware of it, as a Gurdjieffian character, very, very determined, very yogic in his, works 18 hours a day doing his music. A very disciplined, quote, mystic, and knocking all the concepts of mysticism that becomes the New Age. So here's Zappa, but he has a technology, the electric guitar, that McLuhan doesn't have. So Zappa becomes an anti-environment, a transitional anti-environment for a few months. Every now and then, he said there was a new fad every 18 months, so he'd always see what the fad is and then come up with a response, whereas McLuhan could only repeat the larger themes. And so it's very interesting that McLuhan represents the Gutenberg Galaxy idea of getting the overview, that's sort of Platonic, since the book tends to make you Platonic, whereas the Electric Age, which favors the Aristotelian and plunging into the sensory mix, that's Zappa. And Zappa had the advantage of being on Johnny Carson or talk shows, more, which is where he had to get, more than McLuhan, because he had a modern technology. Even though his ideas were rather 19th century as individualistic and preserving the individual genius, so then you begin to think so that Zappa has a mixture and a certain ratios between Aristotelian and Platonism. Lynn LaRouche has another sharing of those ratios. McLuhan has another thing. Then Andy Warhol. And then you bring in the fact of Walter Cronkite or whatever, Dan Rather being a performance artist.
In the pattern you've just pointed out, the common point between Zappa and Gurdjieff is their universality in terms of their approach to art is to bring into high and stark resolve the immediately obsolete environment.
Yes, immediately. That's it. And Zappa could get an album out faster than McLuhan could get a book out.
Well,
and that relates to your article, Charlie. That's why Zappa, he did not, in my interview with him, he says, I would never go into the Soho art scene because it was 60-40 share, 60 for the gallery and 40 cents for the artist. So he found a way to make a lot of money in the commercial market, but do any kind of anti-environmental pattern recognition that any artist could claim, yet he stayed in there and got in the media more than anybody else.
Zappa was, of course, amazing in the continuity of the presence of his image. And, Zappa's physical image was so impressive with the hair,
yeah,
his beard, that incredible voice, his wit. And, of course, a big part of Zappa's practice was that he did no drugs or alcohol. He fired people from his band.
That's the Gurdjieffian part, the disciplinary,
the
yoga.
Because he couldn't have anything drag his mind down. You could argue if you look at the last videos of him when he was dying and he was struggling to hold on, that one of the real problems about being Zappa or Gurdjieff or McLuhan is that you wear yourself out,
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, people wander around with iPhones today, like my girlfriend, for example, and, if you take it away from her, she can't be without it for like seconds.
They're chip body. You cut off her arm.
They're all turning into Gurdjieff and Zappa and McLuhan. We have hundreds of millions of Gurdjieff, Zappa, McLuhans out there.
Okay, let me say this, Charlie. McLuhan recognizes in the early 70s, and he wrote about the effects of the instant replay, which he said was the most profound metaphysical medium that would ever come to humans at that point. And he said, this will lead to the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition.
Yes.
And that leads to burnout in the 80s and 90s.
Yes, and the pattern starts recognizing you rather than vice versa.
Yeah, that's the POMO version. The Android meme sees you and says, oh, what's your latest pattern recognition? Come on in. And you see that the last few years when mainstream TV would put in the chat rooms and YouTubes on their news. It's a matter of who's going to swallow who, right?
Yes. Yes, the devouring devourers.
Yes.
I have to go back to the bathroom. I'm sorry, I just had this operation, so I'll be right back. Stay there.
Yeah, we'll stay tuned. Okay, so Andrew, so this cannibalistic vision, and I'd like him to hear this, I might repeat it, is the vision of Finnegan's Wake. Everybody consuming, and media and senses consuming each other, which is not necessarily a horrific vision, but for most cultures with their perceptual bias that the children are born into, are not equipped to handle the glorious triumph and fun of the cannibalistic world.
Yeah, cannibalistic and scatological.
Yes, yes. The digestive system. I think it's in Stephen Hero, you know, one of his first books, Joyce talks about the common, and McLuhan quotes this in the Renaissance criticism in the 50s, the common thing among all cultures is the digestive system.
Yep.
And I think he talks about that in Notes on Burroughs, too. So, yes, when you say scatological, it's the digestive system. In other words, when you say television or electric environment is extension of the central nervous system, don't think of the central nervous system as just in your skull. It's the whole body, which includes your digestive system and the nerves and all that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm back. I wanted to ask Bob a question. Did McLuhan know Robertson Davies in Toronto?
Yes. He was a professor in the other college. I think it was Trinity College. He certainly, and they did not talk. They would not, no.
Yeah, I've had a feeling that was true.
Well, Robertson Davies, he pretended to be a 19th century novelist. And that was the very thing that McLuhan criticized from the beginning. He wrote to his mother.
Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
That's why I asked the question.
Right. The debates, you can maybe some of them are on YouTube, between Norman Mailer and McLuhan are fascinating. But I want to say this. When he put out Mechanical Bride in 51, he wrote a letter to his mother, who was his main influence, because she was an elocutionist and performer of culture all over the place in the 20s and 30s. And he would hear all the great classics of the Gutenberg Galaxy rehearsed in his home. So that's how he knew all this stuff as a kid. It was like his radio. But he writes to his mother in 1951 that Mechanical Bride is a new kind of novel, particularly a science fiction novel where the ads and comics are the characters. Now think of that sentence.
Wow.
That's ahead of Philip K. Dick or anybody. J.G. Ballard. It's really an update and understanding of Finney's Wake. And so when you read his analysis of Finney's Wake, he's including that percept. And so he was adding, as Joseph Boyce said to me, I wrote two extra chapters in 1951 to Finney's Wake. He claimed he added chapters. And so McLuhan was doing the same thing. He was updating, keeping the perceptual process that the Finnegan's Wake was going by knowing that the characters in Finnegan's Wake were media, like ads and comics. So he's now showing the ads and comics and the commentary between them with the verbal voice in between, in the interval. That would be his commentary within the book. And all of it is a dramatic play.
And so that brings us back around, I guess, to that social network pitch joins branding exhibitionism article that you sent through, Bob.
Mm-hmm. Just before you do that. So, Margaret Atwood had a higher profile than Robertson Davies in the 70s. So, Marshall had no problem saying, and I eventually told Margaret this, he said, I cannot read one paragraph of Margaret Atwood. It is so ridiculous. Now, the reason he's saying that is that the stupid thing is in one language. It's only in English. You got to deal with more than 10 languages on a page like Finnegan's Wake. That was his starting point. So a guy like Robertson Davies, but for McLuhan, Davies didn't exist. He was silly. He wrote books, the guy. Novels.
Well,
go ahead.
He did write the greatest novel about being an artist.
What's that called?
What's Bread in the Bone.
Okay. Now, that's about the Gutenberg artist. We're calling the art world that you deal with the Gutenberg artist. And the tension is, it begins with, you know, because, what was that called? Earth art. People starting to do art outside of the museum. And, you know, and you read under Medium as a Massage, McLuhan makes fun of the museum. And that's him and Cage collaborating on that project. The question is, what becomes the museum? What becomes the place to deposit your pattern recognition? And you monitor the tourists, which are the rich, who hang out in New York City because they can't go anywhere else. They're all alienated from the people because they're too rich. They're like celebrities. And so what's their activity is to exchange objects or to meet and mingle around that kind of old pattern recognition. Now, that's what you confront. And when Andrew says that you're you're not just a creator. You're a performance artist. You're actually a creator of patterns. You just found a way to do it in the old art world or that context, but you're always dealing with the present in your patterns, not even about the art you're reviewing almost.
Well, I'm having some bleeding here, so I think I'm going to have to sign off because I got to go deal with this. But
okay, so we're having a tremendous conversation. Can we continue next week?
Well, give it 2 weeks because I have to go into the hospital this week, so maybe in a couple of weeks.
Perfect. We'll pick up. We haven't even begun.
I'll be in touch. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
I appreciate it.
I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, good luck. Okay, Andrew, how long did we go? An hour?
That's pretty much exactly 1 hour.
Okay, maybe we could discuss what we couldn't get to with him right away. I want him to back. See, this is the kind of talk we need. We need to have someone from the art world talking about what people are doing and then overlay our patterns in response to that, or anti-patterns. Because your question about social media that he sent us about Josh Harris, who did the pseudo.com habitat in New York in the late 90s, tried to redo Warhol's factory. Here's Josh Harris right now, this past week, offering to businessmen a new pattern to how to use social media. And Walter Charlie sent us that article. That's what I want to begin with the next time he comes on, because we're just getting there. And never before have we had someone talk and bring up Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it was nice. It was real nice.
So now they got me worked up. The cognitive thrills of pattern recognition leads to burnout. And it's interesting he sees Zappa, McLuhan, and someone else as burnt out from trying to comment on the present. I think McLuhan was aware of that and didn't mind dropping out occasionally. I remember Morris McLuhan, his brother, telling me, we're backing off from the international stage for a while. This was in 1971. And basically, he's just going to operate locally. Now, he always was global because people would interview him. But he was not running out there like he was in the 60s. And he constantly knew to back off on that. And then
Yeah, no, I was just saying, there's in that the New American Vortex, he addresses that point head on. And so this is just mid-40s, and he's talking about how the mind and the persona engage in these particular ways gains more zest. So if you're...
Okay, I missed your words there. You said the mind gains more zest?
Yeah, the mind, and I guess the mind in that sense, it's an embodied mind, gains more zest. And so he's addressing this issue of energy and engagement in mid-45.
Is it gaining more zest because it's on the drug of electric pattern recognition provided by the media?
He's unclear about that. That's where gaining and sharing in the same energies that you have when you're exercising your mouth. So presumably, engaged in dialogue and speech and in talking, in critical thinking.
Okay, wouldn't you say that would be values in the early McLuhan? The later McLuhan in the 60s would recognize the obsolescence of that zest.
Yes. Now, that's the interesting thing is, did it grow to be more expansive, so it's talking, engaging in multiple modes, and is a
all media are words. That's what he was saying. So he continued talking by using nonverbal media as much as he could.
And then the question is then in embracing that, I guess that larger scope of authorship, whether you do actually put your physical and chemical body at risk.
Right. What was your phrase? Scope of authorship? I didn't get what you said.
Yeah, the scope of authorship, the canvas upon which you write, and the modes that you use as your paintbrushes.
Now, remember last week I was saying that science can only be, in its theories, analogical. It can only get the analogical level of electric extensions.
Yep.
What you just said, talking about the authorship, and then the Barth influence with the word text, and text applied to not just written materials. The last literate discourse is using literate terms like author and text and having it mean what McLuhan meant by media. And as you just said it, that language doesn't even work today. The mouth does not work today. Well, maybe mine does. Maybe the only mouth that survives. But the I'm just thinking that to call something authorship, that's what you have to do in your university environment. That's an accepted term, right?
Yeah, and so it's just trying to gesture in as technical way as possible towards this act of somehow altering or uttering yourself.
Yeah, so, you know, the university, the city that preserves, it's the theme park for the Gutenberg Galaxy. All the arts and disciplines that came through Gutenberg are preserved in the university, which is our, well, in the 70s was our modern city, the real city. And, you know, all the artists like Charlie's friend Carolee Schneeman, they'd be starving on the sidelines while professors who talked about Carolee Schneeman would have good functioning incomes in the universities. I may occasionally bring Carolee in for a guest or something. I actually talked to Carolee about this and Michael Snow. So the Gutenberg Galaxy, archetypalized in the university, it can only see the post-parallel paramedia escape, mediascape that McLuhan talked about and Croker developed as the word under the word virtualization. The universe can only see that in Gutenberg terms, and that's what Barth and Derrida did. They provided literary references by saying there is no more author, but then the authorship becomes the user or the consumer, always looking at things through the filter and bias of literacy. That's the university as museum's role. And so you're forced to use those terms, authorship, as your ground in that environment.
Yeah, as soon as you pull the visual gradient from underneath the university, there's not a lot of talk that goes on or can go on here.
Yeah, it's not markable. It's not you can't judge people. You can't test them, see what degree or department they're in. And that
there's no foundation for the difference at all.
Right, and that was a crisis in the 70s and 80s, and Frank Zingroni wrote about that in the Toronto Popular Press. And now it's impossible. The university is so ridiculous today. I mean, how can this woman he mentioned, Kiki or somebody, does the chat room art? Okay, somebody like yourself say, I could do a course on this. I'll propose it to the department head, and we'll bring her over and have a lecture by her and show her work. And yet the categories that you would put it in are ridiculous. Not that you would, but generally, the way it would be discussed. The artist should object to going to the university and being a guest of honor.
Well, yes and no. I mean, like one of the things that I think that came up as we were talking through today with Charlie is that all of these ancient modalities of art, like the Gutenbergian artist, the radio era artist, you know, working on chemical level terms, all these different old media forms, they have. They're still going, either in after-image or after-image, and so the university is a kind of museum where people might deposit their alterings or utterings. Sure, it's puny in terms of the grand scheme of things, but there are still at least after-images of walls here. Bob, are you still there, or have we dropped out?
Yeah, no, I was on mute, sorry. I said McLuhan was ultimately a professor as performance artist and Noah's Ark for visual space. He actually was trying to preserve the values of the Gutenberg Galaxy, and the university was the proper forum for that because you had, it's the newest city, you had a larger audience of students, so you could do your work there. I'm saying that role, that necessary role of the university, which your statements just seem to express the values of, they're gone by the 90s or by now. The university is a museum of visual space is not useful anymore. And the kids don't even use it for that anymore. But it was an important museum and archetype in the 70s and 80s. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now it's shifted to, I think as we were talking about last week, it's like a eugenics and genes.
Genetic engineering? Yeah, epigenetics?
It's a facility for brokering romance and creating a better gene pool, Bob.
Yeah, a nano community. You talk about romance. Let's call it finding a nano community where just connecting with one other person is enough of a sense of community for an immigrant. Romance is a nano community. And considering that everybody has four or five bodies with the chip body and the TV body, every person is a little group, a little crowd. So you get a romance going, you've got 10 people there. 10 bodies.
And I guess the site, like libraries, are having a renaissance at the moment, an absolute renaissance. The new library that it's, because I've been through a massive transformation. I think that was one of the last books that McLuhan was writing. He was actually writing it with Bob Logan, that, you know, the library was going to be where it was at. And I guess now we're seeing the fruits of that revolution. And that's the best place for people to find dates these days, is in the library. All the kids go there.
But they're going to the library to be on the internet, like at Fort Polk at the University of Toronto?
Yeah, to be in a library, in a book, to be listening to a podcast, and to be Facebooking. And it's a place where these five bodies, or four bodies, or eight bodies, or 22 bodies, can be in sort of relative close proximity.
Yeah, I got a couple of patterns from that. McLuhan said in the late 60s that the city becomes sacred. Well, then he writes in 1970 that the university is a new city. So the university becomes the sacred space, because the ground is information pattern recognition. The university is the Noah's Ark of pattern recognition for a Gutenberg version. So if you're going to find community for your chemical body in an information society, you go to the Museum of Information, which is the university. So it has that charisma right there. It's a sacred spot. And it provides public resources like the internet stuff there and all the books. And it is, in a way, focusing on the last vestige of the chemical body. Because I say the chemical body, my term there is the result of the telegraph. The telegraph, for scientists to start mapping the interior landscape and getting chemistry ideas and subatomic physics, all that is trying to define matter in the chemical body terms. So a lot of visual space really is a product of the chemical body and the disciplines that came out of that since the telegraph. And so that is what's engaging romance, is the effect of the telegraph. Because the telegraph, it's the beginning of the extension of the central nervous system, but it's not collective like the radio. It's not collective like television. And so you still could have a body. The body was still, the physical body could still seem dominant in the 19th century, while sort of inspired, like Nathaniel Hawthorne and some of the other novelists who were noticing the nervous membrane of the telegraph, while inspired by this, you know, images of global unity, which probably motivated the workers of the world and the communists and the socialists and all those people trying to have union collectives. That was the celebration of the chemical body and its last attempt. So we see the death of the chemical body is not happening in the last 30 years. In terms of fundamentalist end times and that happened in the 19th century. And what we see in the end of the 20th century was the death of the TV body or the broadcast analog bodies. You have something to say to that before I go on again?
Yeah, I think it's like it's the necessary adjunct to the university at the moment is the big music festival. So it's like whenever you're talking about the university, I think you also have to be talking about the big music festival at the same time.
Good point. McLuhan said that Woodstock, you know, 40 years ago, were the new phenomenon of instant cities. See, so the festival is the electric city. The university preserves the Gutenberg city archetype, both dealing with the ground of information. Now, when you're a university student, the big existential dilemma is, should I drop out of this Gutenberg bastion, even though you don't even think of it as that, should I drop out of this city and go to the counter city, Lollapalooza or Burning Man? Those are the counter environments, counter cities. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so they don't worry about whether to go join a community in New York City, an art community, a writer's community, or a commune, which people thought in the 60s. Those are chemical body communities. What people, the alternative to the university city is to go to a miniaturized version of the global theater, the global circus. So you go to a festival. And because it's not based on print, the turnover of experience through music and electrified media is faster than waiting to read a book to get a sense of community. So it's eye versus ear. Now, this is really good. It's eye city versus ear city. Now, not eye versus ear. That's just limited to the chemical body. We got to use environments. So in the global theater, McLuhan said the satellite says that every city becomes a suburb of every other city around the planet. You now have, iconically, the battle of which city, style of city you want to join. You want to join the ear city, that's the festival. The eye city is the university. Or the tactile city of a chat forum or something online, making your own YouTubes. What would we call that?
I'm saying that they're merged, Bob. That it's the the Air City is the necessary a respite from these little 12-week gigs at iCity. And so
right. You said the Air City is. Say it again. Is a what? A respite?
But yeah, it's the natural respite. So there's an ecology here.
Yes.
And the tactile. The online world, the chat communities and stuff, are the glue that binds, well, not necessarily the glue that binds, but they go around in between and through both of these alternate scapes.
Yeah, because everybody's a satellite broadcast. Everybody's, the internet allowed people to become their own satellite, orbiting around the previous media, just like Sputnik and the 60s NASA efforts were private citadel of media environments rotating the whole global theater, right? So you can do that digitally, beginning with Web 1.0. So now we get back into Occupy Wall Street. Charlie brought up the point that he loves having an audience, right? And he loves his audience. He works for his audience. We need to talk to Charlie in the future about where is formal causality, which is the Aristotelian term for the audience as defined by McLuhan. Where is an audience today? And we were saying last week that Web 3.0 is where one gets used to the fact and celebrates the fact they don't care about the audience. The audience serves them, and you're not doing it for the audience. If there's any after image of audience, it's fine with you, but as a, quote, god on Web 3.0, you don't care about the audience.
Yeah, that's maybe a nice way of actually summing up possibly the obsolescence of McLuhan. Like McLuhan, I think on various points said that his whole approach is essentially audience study.
Yes.
And now we're dealing with we're well past the death of audience and audiences.
Remember he said the definition of global theater, everybody's crew and there are no spectators. Well,
yeah.
Update, yeah, there's no audience.
And we've replayed that how many times now? Like
yes, holeopathically. Look at my tiny note chart for the phases since 1960. So here's the interesting thing, that connecting, this whole internet world means connecting with somebody, one person or three people or a million people, is your audience. Finding an audience is the rearview mirror work. Remember McLuhan said that the time of the phonetic alphabet, they lived visually and began to be conceptually fragmented, but thought mythically, like pre-Homer thinking was the content of the Greek culture. Then he said the 20th century, the kids live mythically, but think in 19th century terms. Remember that? So in our present situation, we live, well, we don't even live, or we don't limit ourselves to the life as a chemical body defines it. We live in a virtual way, the way Croker defines very well in all kinds of paragraphs in his various books, and we think analog media, and that's Lance Straight and media ecology people. We think media is our content, but we live non-media, paramedia, no audience. So I'm updating that McLuhan pattern.
Yeah, I mean, that's the epidemic of our time, isn't it, Bob?
Yes. And, you know, McLuhan said I got the idea from him, that genius is knowing how to live today, not your particular talent or skill. It's how to mix all these cultural after images that you have to deal with every day and figure out your identity in relation to them. So if genius was knowing how to live today, is it sub-genius now? The issue of living well today is a lot more complicated than a McLuhan's day. If genius is knowing how to live in this situation, man, you got a lot more issues than McLuhan brought up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, the artistry of consciousness itself has become a much more complicated situation.
Yeah, and I like the way Ion says that there is no consciousness. Does not use those terms, subconscious, conscious, and consciousness. And there's a precedent in McLuhan. He said the subconscious is the immediate environments around you, and the consciousness is the attempt to make a pattern out of it. And a lot of people don't bother making willfully, as an agent making a pattern, they just take what's in the news. That's why they read movie reviews. They read art reviews. That's why they read the news, the paper, or now go online and see what the Drudge Report is or whatever their favorite news source, to get a pattern given to them, and that's their little module of consciousness.
Yeah, well,
so,
I mean, like, let's apply what you just said, like the epidemic, that you, as you diagnose it, still thinking analog media terms to discuss the new situation. It's got to apply to consciousness as well. Like consciousness becomes interesting without that visual gradient of inside outside.
Right, and so those categories don't work. Now I think Croker's works do a good job.
It doesn't work, but like it needs to be updated. I still quite like the consciousness word. It seems to express there's a something which it's pointing in the direction of, or
we do have an eyeball. We do have an eyeball, and you cannot get rid of a meme. So the part of yourself that requires those literate categories is there. It's a subset. But you don't want to kill it. You want to be able to think and talk in obsolete Gutenberg terms, but that's only one-fifth of your dialogue and of your attempt to sculpt consciousness. So using multiple body models is the beginning point. And so you have to the image you have of McLuhan was all about saying that if we're going to talk about consciousness, you must include whatever the discarnate evokes, the term discarnate evokes in you, you must include that to the old image of the biology and the ears and nose and the legs and the organs. You know what I mean? That you cannot limit yourself to that image of what you are if you're going to define consciousness.
Yeah, or it's, I guess, how we're...
And that's not mystical. Here's the point, Andrew. People thought that's mystical. No, it was actually not mystical. It was like stubbornly practical and conservative. It was Catholic. That's what the Catholic did. If you think of Catholicism and its dogma and the image of Catholic mainstream religion as not mystical, then that's what Marshall was.
Depends. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe did the Chinese look in at the Irish pub as, like, a strange institution of Western mysticism?
Yeah.
To the outsider looking in, there's...
There's what?
Well, it's where you draw the line as to what's mystical, spiritual, or simply pragmatic or abstract.
Let's not use the term where you draw the line. It's where you tune your guitar.
Yeah, okay, we can go with guitar, but like a guitar's got a lot of lines. It's got six of them.
Right, that's good. That's string theory. String theory is the literate scientific establishment trying to catch up to the electrified acoustic space.
Yep.
Hey, can you hear that sound in the background? Should I close the windows? Is it a little loud?
It sounds like somebody is cutting something or trimming some landscape.
Yeah, so it is coming through. So let me shut the windows. I just opened them. I had them shut for the past hour or so. And then it got quiet, so I thought that they stopped, and they fucking opened, they start up again. So you know they got me under surveillance here, and they're just trying to bug me, right?
Yeah, so there's a noisy flux when there is no boundary, and so you've just got to prop up a bit of a visual gradient and create an inside.
Yeah, I got to use my mouth when I'm talking to people, but I'm fully aware that background noise was really what we're talking about and was a better expression of anything than we could ever come up with.
Sure.
It was the forging of new stages of consciousness. That's what it sounds like, folks. But back to what were you saying about something? Your last question again.
No, I'm just saying so Eliot, you know, they said of Eliot, he took the rhythms of the train and pushed it into poetry. And I guess those people that are creating popular music today, I think the best description I heard recently of one guy was a warlock, a sound warlock of the monotonous electronic drone. And so in a certain sense, he's giving expression to exactly that weed eater kind of sound that was outside your window.
Well, that's in the realm of pattern recognition. He wants to highlight a pattern acoustically in the noise. See, so every art, science is always trying to, the Human Genome Project was trying to map out a pattern about what our genes were made up of. Every institute is trying to create an archetypal pattern. And to live with the fact that that will not succeed in any discipline is how you begin to survive, or that's a challenge for you. So I'm thinking, I love talking to Charlie, and I'm going to go back and read a lot of his columns because I engaged a lot in the art world, or observed galleries and things from 1993 to 2007. They all fell short, And I like to hear about artists I wouldn't know about because he's more in touch. He's like an Eskimo. He can see 50 kinds of snow, right? So he sees all this art stuff that's part of his business. So we get an interesting inventory. But I tell you, not one of them is relevant unless they know how to live. And so he was saying that woman who does the chat form artifacts, chart form, she's obsessed with it. They don't know how to get meaning in other activities. So they fail and become an artist and get paid for it or whatever and get shown in galleries, but that's a failure because you're being limited. You don't understand what's driving you. So that's why I always said I was the greatest artist or scientist, because I'm always dealing with the hidden ground of the neurosis you get into in forming consciousness. Now, I don't have a problem that people are neurotic, but I can make them think past what they thought they were thinking about. And that is what an artist used to do with artifacts, make you think past what you thought. Now, the Android meme does that every day, 24/7, and we even can say we've gotten to the point now where the Android meme doesn't do it anymore. There's no pattern recognition offered now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess part of that, when you're talking about shifting of perception, I mean, I guess we're talking about that in what has been talked about in broadcast terms. I mean, the fact that we have a collective that have a unified perception or mode of looking, post-death of the audience, that doesn't exist. So the artist will never have the full universality of what they're doing ever registered.
Right. So if McLuhan quoted that, whoever, the anonymous person in the 60s, art is anything you can get away with. Today, staying alive is anything. Staying alive with your five bodies and coming mergers is what you get away with today. Like, people do, why do people make art? Why do they want to fit into that environment? Probably to get some money rather than working in an office or a factory. So the idea is to get some money. Then you have your autonomy to engage your other bodies with not too much pressures from the chemical bodies, survival pressures. You know what I mean? So to survive is the goal of every operation and institution on the planet today. To survive itself. And more, that's becoming impossible. So right today or this weekend, they're deciding whether there's going to be a Euro community or a Eurozone or a Euro, right? That's a massive environment that can't have any staying power. You know, the fundamentalists saw the rise of Europe and the integration of Europe in the 90s as prefiguring the Antichrist. They never foresaw that, oh, well, they could be the Antichrist for about 3 years, and that's that, because they'd be obsolesced by newer environments. Now, it says in the fundamentalist vision that the tribulation is 3.5 years. We could take any 3.5-year phase over the past 30 years and call that a tribulation. And then Jesus was supposed to come back, right? Well, Jesus, did he come back as a new technology, which then was obsolete, so then there was another Jesus? This is where the term in the church subgenius of the short-durational personal savior, that would be an environment or an object, and that's part of the humor of the subgenius. They make any environment, any object, your personal savior. But that process, that neurosis, that appetite of desire will do you in also. So you need a X-ray of that stuff, the values the church of subgenius hoik up.
Yep.
For those who want to survive. Now, suicide, McLuhan questioned in the 50s, maybe suicide isn't bad. You know, suicide is an appropriate response to constant seduction to be burnt out.
And yeah, that's also a dimension, though, of is if there's Menippean satire in a sense as well, though, Bob. Isn't the oldest surviving book, an Egyptian book about suicide?
And you mean the Egyptian Book of the Dead?
No, this is pushing me in directions I haven't been for a little while. I think the oldest surviving book or thing that they call a book is a treaty on whether suicide is a viable option.
Okay,
so
very good.
So to be talking about that in the book form is probably the best way to gesture in terms of universality. If you go from suicide all the way through to Finnegan's Wake, you've pretty much covered the whole life of letters.
Good point. And then you have to look at the Eskimo culture, which I have not lived among them. This is what they say they did, is that they would die by leaving the tribe, wandering off and freezing to death. They would commit suicide. That was the regular way to transition. Did you know that?
I'm familiar with the meme.
Yeah, that idea. So let's say I would say that today people could commit suicide in many ways, in their TV body, their chip body, their astral body, but not their chemical body. But you can commit suicide on the other body's level. And actually they say, you know, if you get a scandal by the 90s, if you do a scandal like recently Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan, they commit TV suicide all the time by destroying their image with some latest scandal, and that keeps their image going. So even with the theme or meme of suicide, you got to reference which body you're talking about. So suicide bombers. Now then you talked about the drone weapon. Everything is a weapon today. Every human and multi-body expression is a weapon, is an act of violence. That's what McLuhan spelled out in 76 in his article for Canadian Forum, I think the magazine was, or Saturday Night. He said, looking at the media as violence. And he defined violence as the act of getting knowledge, crossing boundaries. That's an act of violence, that's knowledge, and that's why it's on the first page of Finnegan's Wake, Viollor
d'Amour. I read that differently, like in terms of, it's interesting, like that under conditions of total change and flux, there can be no violence, but there is no transgression of a boundary that is significant.
Good point.
So most of what we've seen for the last 50 years is a nostalgia for violence, a nostalgia for the boundaries that would allow us to transgress.
And I think that's crash theory. That's Croker. That's where McLuhan's obsolete. That to talk about the violence of the media is just to being a janitor or a music curator, whereas the celebration of crashing, and that, let's in light of what we said, let me read a couple lines from Croker again on art. Reread it. Art becomes interesting only when it does. Now think of any action by any of the five bodies or humans as art. Art becomes interesting only when it does not exist except as a sign of its own liquidation.
Yep.
You've got to be a suicide even to get on the map. A manic art of dispersion and retrieval that marks the dissolution and cancellation of the social field. In other words, there's nobody to connect to, no audience. A quantum art that moves into sonic overdrive, actually dissolving into a detritus of acceleration and infinite speed. Now go back up to the paragraph just before. Art then is a quantum singularity. In other words, surviving today is a quantum singularity in which all the energies of the black hole of, he has America, but we'll call it the Android meme, fall back upon themselves, concentrating with their energy until it pulses and implodes. Here, suicide is a culture lab for working out the inner laws of Android meme technology and power.
Yeah, well, he knew that the black hole took us to the edge of theory, and he went straight there.
He said the black hole, see, I missed, I dropped my phone. What did you say? He knew the black hole?
Croker knew that black holes took us to the edge of theory, and so he went straight there in terms of talking about quantum singularities.
Yeah, you had to begin with physics, and physics was the establishment. The CERN boys over there in Switzerland trying to get their funding renewed by claiming they've got a particle that goes faster than what Einstein projected is the speed of light. That's the established, that's the church. You got the Vatican in trouble, you got the major big science in trouble, and they're panic science, and they are the establishment. You'd find a lot of the artists that and Charlie mentioned this, they're literate, they're up-to-date, sophisticated people. They read Scientific American. They look at scientific theories and experiments and journalistic phenomena to get material to make a pattern out of, to create a counter-pattern. And I remember McLuhan said that in Take Today in 1972 that art becomes science and science tends to go towards becoming an art. McLuhan provides the last categories. You know, he's not the last philosopher, the last thinker, or this or that. He provides the last categories to prepare for a living McLuhanism, which is exemplified by Croker, where he can drop McLuhan's categories and get into the issue that makes McLuhan's categories obsolete. But McLuhan did provide the final forces of form, the lineaments of form. And then you look at Finnegan's.
Yeah. Yeah, you just sparked another a thought. Do you remember those old McLuhan's Baedekers? Like, and I remember there was one where they were doing from
the graphs,
yeah,
the charts.
the big charts.
Yeah.
And one of the themes that came out of that was this battle between where the latest discovery was coming out of, and more often than not, there was an oscillation between chemistry and physics as to who was providing, like, the most up-to-date information, innovation.
That's a really good point, because when cold fusion, when Pons and Fleischmann came out in 89, they were chemists invading the world of physics. And, of course, the physicists said they're jokers. They don't even belong here. And that was one of the first conundrums. How come chemists came up with the new technology or hinting of new technology, which was supposed to be the realm of physics? So, and so that's a really good point, because Baudrillard takes physics as the standard and those concerns. See, if McLuhan is trying to figure out which is the most important invention, looks at chemistry and physics, he's missing Baudrillard's insight, who notices that Baudrillard is the new invention, because he's able to make fun of and adopt whatever models science and chemistry and physics come up with and play with them. And that action is the same action as being a news journalist. What do news do? We see it the way the journalists go in and talk to Occupy Wall Street. They always just consume them, and they make fun of them or make a pattern or edit to make the person look stupid. The journalist is the terrorist. He's the one who comes in, is going to take the events of the day, make a pattern, and make the journalist or the job of being a news broadcaster more important than any of the content.
Yeah.
So where did that come from? So pattern recognition, chemistry and physics. So that chart was – they were doing that in the early 70s, McLuhan and Eric and them. What is your point? Go back to your Gutenbergian point. What's your point that you're trying to make that they couldn't decide between chemistry and physics?
No, it's not so much they couldn't decide, but I was starting to contemplate as we've looked at various modalities of art and artistry and what those changes mean over time, is also what these change in terms of media dynamics, both when media has actually existed as forms and when they're in the after image, how does that impact which is going to be more the popular, the more relevant realm? It's always interesting that there seems to be, in the same way as certain media environments favor the Republicans and the Democrats, who've got certain media environments or after images of media environments favor looking at things through the lens of physics versus the lens of chemistry and these other. It's just part and parcel of a history that needs to be rewritten, Bob.
I think I got a statement about the history thing. As you know, in the 80s and 90s, there were many cultural commentators in different media who, from the educated, sophisticated McLuhanite, knew that they were presenting McLuhan insights that they didn't even know they were doing, but they were presenting McLuhan. And that's further proof of what I was saying, that McLuhan provides the last categories of a detached participation. And you see the holopathic replays of McLuhan from the John Nesmith and the Alvin Toffler and any other kind of commentators, and then you get into the blogging. They always, when they do a think piece, a big think piece, they always move toward the patterns that McLuhan laid out. That's the only patterns you can come up with if you're going to present a chemical body, verbal mind. So that's the correct history, is that you can't, if you're going to make a justification of whatever you're performing in your blog, whatever you're criticizing or supporting, and then you get shocked by events and changes in that field you're surveying, you know, it's like Charlie's an anthropologist of art. When you get shocked by new developments that affected your particular purview, you then sort of retreat into an identity crisis and try to figure out what it does all mean. And when you get to that kind of big piece perspective article essay of what does it all mean, you fall back onto the mediascape as the bugaboo of everything. Have you noticed that pattern?
Yes.
So that's what I'm just bringing this up in response to what you were saying as proving my point that McLuhan had the last categories. For what? The big view? For the big view? What does he have the categories for?
Maybe that's our next question for Charlie. So, Charlie, for what? That's where we'll start.
Yeah, get it, the what for, McLuhan said. What?
Yeah.
Give us the what for. But Charlie, for me, is an anthropologist of the tribe of art in New York City or any of the other major cities. Because the old Gutenberg city, art is the high priesthood of it. It's actually the religion of the wealthy and those that don't have to be wealthy but are intellectually inclined. and not impressed with going to church, so they go to culture as their sustenance for spiritual inspiration or something, or even physical inspiration. So that was the thing. So that old city role. So here is Walter, who is turned on, inspired by electrified media, the magnetic city environments, the televised global theater of Zappa, and the cream in that. That's what inspires the teenage Charlie. And he then lives in New York City watching The Little Tribe. Remember McLuhan said in 66 when he came to New York, we're going to bury this little city, this little village. So Charlie goes into the little village of the art meme, the Gutenberg art world, and he's an anthropologist of that, but he's constantly relating it to the magnetic city patterns. He's actually a media. See, everybody can't be but a media ecologist, which means judging whatever field they're looking at in relation to what the news says is happening. So you'll get replays of decades with the signposts like 60s, Vietnam, 70s, Iran, 80s, junk bonds, 90s, computers. You know, these iconic images, they're the foundation. They're the actual part of the word that makes the meme that every other discipline is bouncing off of. So everybody's aware of that meme. So what's the meme right now? It could be the Europe meeting. It could be the collapse of Greece. It could be the death of the Saudi prince. It could be the Michael Jackson trial. I don't know. You know what I mean? Different people respond to different parts of the Android meme. But they're all trying to adjust themselves in relationship and create a sense of balance. So it's everybody's a paramedia ecologist or engaged in the job of pattern recognition.
And that, Bob, is probably where we should call it a day for today's session.
Yeah, so I would say that Charlie is, since he is, like everybody's a media ecologist, he's always relating the obscure art world that he encounters in New York City to the larger functions of the Android meme. So he talked about, he's very impressed with the drone artists who are miming a response to the weapons of destruction, the drones, right? See, and they know about the drones through watching it on CNN or something, right? It's just an image. They're not actually going into the factories making the drone. They're not the Pentagon directing the drone. They're responding to a major icon. So everybody is relegated to media ecologists, which is an obsolete reaction to the Android meme that makes the market. So silence is an appropriate response to the Android meme. In other words, watch, monitor, but don't express anything. That's another kind of paramedic ecologist. So art is anything. Oh, now we're coming to the punchline. So being a media ecologist or even a paramedia ecologist is whatever you can get away with. So now I want to finish off with this. I want to address Mark Stallman's useful post on the media ecology list.
Let's not do it now. I can't do it now. Like I've got a whole raft of students coming to me. Like
Oh, okay. You got to go. Well, I'm warning you, Mr. Stallman. We're going to kill you over the next attempt we get to obsolesce your patterns. You're still an analog broadcaster, not a digital. So we could do an enemy or something. Give me a reason. Give me a platform to do this as soon as possible, Andrew.
Yep, I shall do.
Okay. That's it.
Okay, yep, let's shut it down.
And I think I am looking forward to having Charlie back. That's going to be incredible because it's always fun to engage the art world or whatever they think they're doing.
Interesting man.
Yes, so I turn the speaker off, and then I can do the, I assume Carol's not on the line. If you are, disconnect, Carol, and now I go...